Hello and welcome to IT Conversations. I'm your host, Doug Kay, the CEO of RDS Strategies. And in this edition, we're bringing you an unedited presentation by Darryl McBride, the CEO of the SCO Group. His speech entitled, There's No Free Lunch or Free Linux, was delivered by Mr. McBride at Jupiter Media's CD Expo conference in Las Vegas on November 18, 2003. Given the highly polarized nature of the debate over SCO's litigation to pursue its alleged intellectual property rights, we thought it would be best to hear Mr. McBride present his position in his own words. Look for subsequent IT Conversation interviews with experts having alternative views on this subject. And now, here's Darryl McBride, CEO of the SCO Group.
Thanks for all of you coming out today. Let's see if we can get this thing working here. So, I want to talk at the beginning here about a few things, set the stage a little bit. You probably all heard about SCO in the last year. I'd like to set a little bit of the stage about who SCO is, and why, secondly, why maybe you have heard about us in the last year. And then finally, I want to shift gears and talk about how what is going on with our company right now may have an impact on you, your company, and the broader world around us as we go forward. If you look at SCO from a historical perspective, you basically see a leader in innovating in Unix-based solutions. Unix on Intel was really the key thing that this company was known for, going back into the 80s and early 90s. Had a magnificent brand. They were really doing a great job. Developed a reseller network that is still active today of over 11,000, and thousands of developers that were working on SCO products. Along the way, the company has gotten to the point where we are having a number of successes. If you look at just even recently, last month we were named as the top five enterprise operating system company by VAR Business. If you look at the growth factor, in the last 5 years, there have been over $32 billion that have gone into technology companies. If you look at the dot-com bubble, if you look at the number of companies that have survived in the last few years, the investment that has gone in, a number of those companies have been wiped out. In that same period of time, SCO was actually growing its business. We were ranked just a few months ago by Deloitte Technology in their Fast 500 survey as number 75 on that list. So it's a company that is growing in spite of other companies that are not doing well. Recently, we also won an award in India for having the most robust operating system, and this was SCO Unix with our UnixWare product. So that's the basic outline of the company here. Over 2 million servers active and running today, a company that's charging along, selling Unix-based solutions that drive operations inside of major corporations around the world. So SCO is equal to Unix, and that tie-in got even stronger in 1995. If you look at the history of Unix, it was invented at AT&T Bell Labs in the late 60s. I worked at Novell for 8 years, and in 1993, we purchased Unix from AT&T Bell Labs, actually from a division they had there called USL, Unix Systems Laboratories. At that point in time, Ray Norda had a vision of taking Unix and marrying it with NetWare and going out and competing with Microsoft. After Ray Norda retired from the company, new management came in and took a different approach, which led to the sale of the Unix assets to the Santa Cruz operation. So now you have Santa Cruz operation that is already a leader for Unix on Intel solutions that acquires the underlying property rights to all of Unix. And that happened in 1995. In 2001, SCO, Santa Cruz Operation, sold those assets to Caldera, which was a company that was actually spun out of Novell. As an interesting side note, I was approached in 1994 by some employees who wanted to leave Novell and go do a startup called Caldera. I introduced them to Ray Norda. Ray Norda funded Caldera, and so my ties to this company go back nearly 10 years. So in the end, the Unix property ends up getting sold into Caldera, and that's basically the history. Quick history lesson. Now, when you think about Unix, if I would have asked you a year ago, who owns the Unix operating system? You know, go back a year now. What would have been the answer? Would the answer have been SCO? Most likely not. Most likely the answer would have been Sun or IBM or HP, maybe AT&T. So who owns Unix? Who knows? There's a whole bunch of versions of Unix out there, right? Well, it's true that there are a whole bunch of versions of Unix out there. And the important thing to understand about what this organization owns is that we picked up the trunk to the source code rights that goes to the whole tree. So whereas there are many branches of Unix out there, they ultimately all tie in to the same tree trunk. And so when you think about HPUX or IBM AIX, Sun Solaris, these are all licensed products off from this core set of source code technology that SCO owns. This is a very substantial fact when you consider that the world is comprised of two major operating systems. On one hand, you have Windows. On another hand, you have Unix. Windows, obviously very strong at the desktop, all the way down to the consumer, major market share. They've kept this all in-house. They've built a very big business there, without a doubt. On the other side here, you have Unix-based operating systems. For as strong as Windows is on the desktop, Unix has obviously become very strong inside of businesses, back-end server operations, high reliability, systems that do not break. That's why businesses like Unix. And so you have a Unix marketplace over here that over time has built up to be a $21 billion marketplace. So now you're looking at that, and you come back to this tree here then, and what you see is, I gotta look at the right side here, you see the tree trunk, and again you see SCO running right down the middle of that. You see the other branches of Unix that are tied into the tree trunk. Now, going back to the Windows-Unix analogy again, Windows has proliferated by virtue of how they have gone out and they've taken one approach, sort of a bring everything around Windows and put it all together, sort of a monolithic approach towards the world, and they've been very successful at it. If you look at how Unix has become successful, it has been by taking that source code that underlies Unix and making it broadly available. Going back to our history lesson again, when you have AT&T that owned the property, they took Unix and had a couple of goals with it. One goal was they wanted to make it broadly available around the world. So they put together a source licensing program where virtually anyone could come in and license Unix. And so what you see then are over 6,000 licensees to Unix worldwide. SCO now owns those licenses. The second goal that AT&T had was, if we're going to make this broadly available, we need to make sure that we can protect it. It's actually somewhat of a rarity for an organization to take source code like this and make it so broadly licensed. Certainly Microsoft hasn't done that. Oracle, other software companies don't typically make their source code freely available like this for people to go look at, modify, extend. So the second part of the AT&T contract requirements came down to the point of, we'll make it broadly available, people can develop and work derivatives off from this, but they must keep the confidential nature of that code intact. They cannot take the source code, go out and do things with it, and then turn around and dump the source code or give the source code away or confidentially break the provisions of the contracts in those source code agreements. So this is what Caldera now owns. Now, I joined Caldera about a year and a half ago. At the time that I joined the company, it was an organization whose market cap had gone from nearly $1 billion down to, at the time that I joined the company, it was worth about $6 million, okay? And whereas it was $6 million in value, they were losing $5, $6, $7 million per quarter, and they had less than $10 million in the bank. So a quick math calculation will tell you that they're within about 6 months of hitting the ground. So you've been losing altitude, you've been coming down, you know, from $1 billion down to $6 million in value, and now you're about ready to hit the ground. So this was the company that I chose to join. Gosh, this guy must not have very good prospects. He must have a bad career deal going on. I'd actually had a couple of reasonably good runs in my career at Novell for 8 years. I did a couple of startups that were successful. And I was about ready to do a third startup. I had funding lined up. I was ready to go do a startup. And the startup that I had received money for was valued at $10 million, yet there were only two of us that would be in an executive suite to start this thing. It was going to be a web services company. At the same time, I got approached by the board of directors of Caldera to come in and be the CEO to try and do a turnaround. So I came in and I looked at the assets at a quick glance and I said, gosh, I don't know where this could go, but the fact that they have $60 million in revenue, they own the Unix operating system, and they've got this channel of resellers, this seems easier than doing a startup. So I made a decision to join the company. Came on board, spent about 30 days going through and talking to people inside and outside the company, did a quick audit. And sure enough, as we got in and dug inside of it, my hunch was reconfirmed that in my mind, the single largest asset and most valuable asset that Caldera held was this thing called the Unix operating system. Again, I was with Ray Norda when we bought it the first time, you know, somewhat less than $1 billion. We paid a lot of money for it. Now these guys are holding it, and I'm thinking there's got to be some value in there. So I asked the question to a variety of people throughout the company. Have you thought about enforcing your intellectual property rights that you have on Unix? Have you looked in Unix to make sure you're getting the maximum value out of that? And what I heard back was interesting. I heard two things. First of all, I heard that, in fact, they had looked at that, and in fact, they had seen some potential violations as it related to the new upstart Linux environment. The second thing that I heard was that would be a problem to go down that path, because if we started talking about IP infringements inside of Linux, the company would be crucified by the Linux community. Okay? So now, I'm in this interesting situation. Okay? You have a company that's just about ready to hit the ground. There is absolute shareholder value in this asset called the Unix operating system. But what you're being told is if you go down this path, people are going to get upset at you. Okay? So I went back to my CEO 101 book to understand what is it I'm supposed to be doing as the chief executive officer. My constituents, as I understand them as a CEO, are to shareholders, to customers, and to employees. To get a return on your asset base for those constituents is really the job of a CEO. I didn't see in there that the Linux community was one of my constituents. So I made the hard call of going in and saying, we're going to rally around this core asset. We reorganized the company. We got in a position where we were not losing money. And soon we were at a point where we weren't losing money, but we weren't growing either. Brought on some new management talent, brought on Chris Sontag, who I'd worked with at Novell, to run our new SkillSource licensing division. The initial investigation we found inside of the Linux code base was verified that there were some problems in there. And the first thing we found related to our class libraries. In Microsoft world, those are called DLLs, things that help you launch applications. And so we brought these issues, put them on the table, and Chris had this idea of let's put together a licensing program that will be something anybody in the world can license. And we're not going to be unfriendly to the Linux environment. We're just going to put this out there. And this is just something that you can put on top of Linux. And this will be of great value to the Linux world because it will give you access to these over 4,000 applications that have been written on top of SCO Unix. And for the first time, we'll unbundle our class libraries from the SCO operating environment. So we went down that path, and as we got to a point where, let me just forward here one bit. As we got ready to announce our SCO Source division, we trotted this out to a number of industry partners. And for the most part, it was fairly well received. A number of IHVs and ISVs looked at it. We even went to some of our competitors. We talked to Red Hat and invited them to take this and go license it. And, you know, they politely declined and said, we understand what you're doing and, you know, good luck. And so we were moving along, felt like we were on the right track. There was one organization, however, that really put the hammer down on us. And they basically said, if you roll this out, this is going to be a disaster. We don't want this announcement in the marketplace because it basically implies that there are intellectual property problems with Linux. So as we tried to work through this, we grounded the announcement for a few weeks. This was in December timeframe of last year, and we reset it for launching at Linux World. We finally went through this. We had discussions. In this case, the company was concerned about it was IBM. So we had discussions. We tried to get to a point where we could agree on what we were going to go out with, and we never got there. So by Linux World of this year, we went ahead and announced the library's licensing program. We had an immediate reaction that was very swift from IBM, basically saying at that point in time that if we continued down this path, IBM was going to pull out all of its support for SCO worldwide. About 20% of SCO's operating systems ship on IBM hardware. So we were threatened 2 months before we had any lawsuit in place that if we continued down this path, then you know we were going to be punished for that. So, again, we had a decision to make. I would ask you to put yourself in my shoes. The first decision you had was back in August. You know, do you continue down this path where there's clear value with your asset or not? We continued. We get to January. We now have another very interesting juncture. We have been pushed into a corner, and we've been told very specifically, if you do not retract your press release and if you don't stop talking about this, then the largest computer company in the world is going to pull its support and they're going to go out and encourage others to not support you as well. We came out fighting at that point again. We came out, we said, look, we didn't put this announcement in there to retract it. We're going down this path. IBM themselves collected over $1.5 billion, according to one of the major business publications last year, by enforcing their intellectual property. So we continued down the path. We had some more back and forth. We got, as we got in the middle of this, clearly it became obvious that there were problems inside of the contract relationships that we had with IBM that was independent of these shared libraries announcements. And as we approached IBM on that, they blew us off on that and said they're not worried about it. So we got to a point where we really had one option available to us, and that was the litigation path. So we basically filed a lawsuit against IBM on March 7th of this year. And that basically set in motion a chain of events that have happened over the last 6 months that have definitely made this the most interesting 6 months of my life. And so let me step you through a few more of those, and then I want to shift gears and talk about more at an industry level how this has impacted us and how I think it might impact you. After we filed the lawsuit against IBM, we had a code team, a set of code teams that went in and started evaluating. Basically, what triggered a lot of this when we were hearing the IBM folks talk, they were talking about taking major portions of AIX and moving it into Linux. And as we started evaluating AIX, Linux, System 5, Unixware, sure enough, we saw those things happening. But the other thing that was interesting as we started evaluating the code base down to a fine-tooth comb level was we started to see copyright infringements showing up inside of Linux. We started seeing our code showing up with copyrights stripped off. And these violations were actually independent of the original suit we had against IBM for breaching their AIX contract with us. So as we put in place the next set of announcements, which was sending out letters to the global 1500 companies, letting them know that we had found these violations, this now turned into a much bigger issue. In the first instant, we're fighting against the largest computer company in the world. In the second instance, we're fighting against arguably the largest, one of the largest cultural movements in the world, which is the open source development movement. And so now the question that comes up from many people is, now wait, we need to understand, what is it you're saying you own again? There's a lot of information flying back and forth about what SCO owns. Some like to say they own some ancient version of Unix, okay? Let's be really clear right now as we move through this as to what SCO's ownership rights are by virtue of these acquisitions that were made along the way. So the first thing we'd point to is these are things now, without a doubt, these are not disputed, these are things that SCO owns. The first point is SCO owns all of the Unix System 5 source code. You can go out, download the asset purchase agreement from Novell. It's there in black and white. Other things you'll see in that contract include SCO's ownership to all agreements with all of the Unix vendors. Earlier when we said there were 6,000 agreements out there, there are actually 30,000 contracts with 6,000 organizations. All of the major vendors, all of the major companies out there around the world, we have these Unix vendor contracts with. Third thing, SCO owns all of the Unix System 5 copyrights. There was a point in time where the people that we bought the copyrights from came out and said, wait a minute, those are ours, we didn't really sell those to you. And then 5 days later, we produced an amendment two to the purchase agreement that said, no, actually you did transfer those over officially a year after the first agreement was signed. They then backed off that claim. Next, you see SCO's ownership on all claims for violation of the Unix licenses. Okay, so anything that comes up as a claim around one of these Unix licenses, those are all due to SCO. And then the final point, which ties into the IBM contract case, is SCO owns the Unix System 5 derivative works control rights. So, whereas when you take a source code base and you go modify it, extend it, grow it, do something new with it, you come up with a new version. In IBM's case, they call this AIX. HP's case, they call it UX. As you have derivative works out here, we don't necessarily own that derivative, okay? So if somebody says, you guys don't own AIX, that is a true statement. But if they say, you don't have any control rights over it, that is incorrect. What that means is you can't take the derivative works that are developed under these source code licenses and break the confidentiality provisions. Basically what it means by contract terms is the derivative is treated, confidentially speaking, the same as though it were the original System 5 source code that we licensed to them. So those are the things that are very clear on SCO's ownership rights. If you summarize all of those, basically you're talking about copyrights, trade secrets. We have very strong provisions in these contracts with respect to methods, concepts, and then we have these 30,000 contracts that we mentioned. So the real case then in IBM is really a contract case. And so let's you know, keep that focused over here on the right side. The second part then is when we come up and find these clear-cut copyright violations inside of Linux, that becomes a copyright infringement situation. So whereas the contract case with IBM is on a fuse that will go March 11th, 2005 in a Utah courtroom, the copyright case is something that is near term. We made an announcement this morning that we've expanded our retention agreement with David Boyce, who did the litigation against Microsoft in the antitrust case, and he is now taking on the issues of going out and enforcing our rights from a legal perspective against those who may be using Linux. Now, what this has created is a set of urban legends that are starting to scroll, and almost on a daily basis, we start to hear a new myth or set of things that are projected as fact that we view as being much different. So I'd like to scroll through for just a moment and address some of those head on. First urban legend that we hear about, this McBride guy. You know, all of a sudden I go from being like a normal technology dude over the last 15 years to now I'm some kind of penguin slayer, otherwise known as some kind of Suhappy cowboy. My response to that one is it's only half true. I will admit to the cowboy part, but not to the Suhappy. We filed one lawsuit in this case. On the cowboy provision, we do have a lot of horses, and in fact, I grew up around a lot of horses, and if you go look at my birth certificate, this is a true story now, no urban legend, on my birth certificate, under father's occupation, it says cowboy, okay? So I will admit to being a cowboy, but not to being Suhappy. Second myth, SCO wants to destroy open source and Linux. Fact of the matter is, we think there's a lot of merit to the open source model. You know, SCO, through the Caldera side of the business, obviously was one of the early entrants into the open source environment. They didn't do very well. They, from a financial standpoint, they were kind of back in the pack, so to speak, with respect to some of the other players. But certainly, the whole open source notion, the ability to get thousands of people around the world working on a project and being able to advance that, is very interesting. We do believe very strongly, though, that for this to be able to move forward, that there needs to be appropriate checks and balances in the Linux process, in the open source process. And we think that if this is corrected along the way. We think we think Linux is going through growing pains right now, but we think there is a way for all of us to coexist peacefully. The next myth, you know, the end users are safe in taking a wait and see approach to SCO's position. One of the ideas out there is, hey, I'm a Linux end user, I'm running Linux today, but I'm just going to hang out and wait and see how the IBM case turns out, and then I'll make a decision as to what to do. Where we are on this one, as we talked about this morning, is that we have two issues here. One is contract-based, the other one is copyright-based. We talked about our copyright issues in the summer time frame. There were a number of organizations that came forward and said, can you put together a licensing program? Can you put together something that I can take a license from you rather than having to go through the litigation process? So we accommodated that request. We put one in place, and so that's where we are now. As we announced today, we are prepared that to the extent that, customers do not want to take a license or they have questions about the strength of SCO's claims, we will accommodate them from a litigation perspective if that's the desire. David Boyce announced this morning that the expectation is within 90 days we would have probably be in a court setting with at least one customer. You know, the next one we hear a lot about. If SCO would simply show open source community the code, we could change it overnight and we'd be done with this whole issue. You know, the fact of the matter is SCO has been showing the code. We'll continue to show it. We have certain portions of it that are under confidentiality provisions. We have shown those under confidentiality agreements. We have a lot of other code that we've been showing. We've shown nearly a million lines of this code that relate to contracts that we have. We haven't heard any comments back on that. We have basically the second piece of this, you know, is this something that can be cleaned up easily? It's not going to be remedied alone by code removal. You know, we rolled some code out in August. Immediately, the open source community said, we took that out, okay, of the next version of Linux. Well, they took it out of the next version of Linux, but there are millions of servers running around out there today that still have it in there. We have methods and concepts protection in our contracts clauses. So if somebody goes out, they're a Unix engineer, work, 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 code, 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 and then they, the next day, come in, take those methods, concepts, and transport them into Linux. You know, when you go take that code and rework it, it still falls under the methods and concepts confidentiality provision. So it's not as simple a task as many would have you believe, and it's all tied back to the strength that we have in these contract rights and legal rights that we picked up from AT&T. Next myth, SCO wants to destroy the GPL. Our view on that is that IBM, in fact, is the one that has put the GPL at risk. When we filed against IBM, we didn't even mention the word GPL. We didn't even talk about it. In August of this year, IBM came back and countersued us and put the GPL between IBM and SCO. They put it into the line of fire. Now, from our perspective, from our legal guys looking at this perspective, they were very happy to see this. We have very strong rights, and we think we have a very strong case against the GPL. And so the fact that IBM has put it on the table, there is no doubt the GPL is at risk right now. But let's all keep in mind the history of this, that we are not the ones that put it there. That came from IBM. So now we get to this whole notion of the whole concept of free. You know, we've been leading up to this. We've been talking about Linux. You know, right after I joined the company, there was an article that came out in Business Week that was called, it was on the cover heading, I think it was, Why Do Companies Love Linux? So I'm the new CEO of a Linux company, so I'm turning the pages, and I get there, and the answer is, it's free, okay? So, okay, I understand the free concept. I mean, consumers love things that are free. You know, at our place in Salt Lake City, the furniture store, every Saturday morning, they have free hot dogs, and people flock into the store and spend thousands of dollars on a furniture so they could get that 35-cent free hot dog, you know? The free concept is a very powerful one. And the more you have a free something or other out there, the more adoption you're going to have. If you look at how standards get driven, you take the price down, you get it down to zero, you get it out there, adoption goes way up if it's something of value. If you look at where Linux is, Linux has become broadly available because the value proposition is what? Unix for free, okay? So this whole thing has been building up around free and how well that works. Well, now we have to step back and start challenging this free notion a little bit. Let's Before we answer that, as it relates to Linux, let's look at how free has worked in some of the other industries. If you look at, let's see, I'm going to forward on to one more here. If you look at some of the other models that are out there, free music as an example, you know. I mean, the question here is, what is the price of free? You know, start with free love. I wasn't actually around in the 60s, but I see a few people in the audience that could maybe comment on why there was a price attached to free as it related to that phenomenon in the 60s and 70s. But on a serious note, moving to the economic side of this, Napster got quick adoption by being free. Free music, everybody understood. Instead of going into the CD store, you had 40 million people going online and downloading and getting their songs for free. Okay? Then all of a sudden, what happens? The brakes hit. The legal side hits. Lawsuits hit. And people start slowing down on downloading of music. I have a friend who's big-time professional, master's degree in the advertising industry. He has thousands of songs that he's downloaded. And it was only been within the last couple of months that he said he was really bummed out about what the RIAA was doing, okay, which was going out and suing customers, end users, I should say. Why was he, I said, why are you upset? Are they suing you? And he said, no, they're not suing me, but I'm afraid they might, so I got to stop doing this now. Okay? So this notion of free is good, but there's a price attached to it. In the music case, you have a legal problem. The internet, the whole .com mess, you had free, everything was about eyeballs. We're going to have all of this free internet. And it fueled billions and billions of dollars of investment. And for as fast as this thing grew up, it came crashing down within months after the whole thing went out of control. Okay? If you look at what's happened in the telecom world, the quality that's gone down since everybody tried to go to this low or cheap bandwidth, you look at this time after time and you come to understanding that free models don't work. Going back to the question on Linux then, how has this worked? Let's go back and look at the history of those who have been doing the whole distribution side of Linux. In the late 90s, how many Linux distros were there out there? I mean, there's probably some Linux gurus here that know this a lot better than I, but there were a lot. I know that when I originally talked to IBM, they had, I think, like a dozen distros that they were trying to certify to. Okay? If you go talk to them today, how many distros are they certifying to? Right? And so, basically, what was that? Sounds like we have an expert here. The answer is now 5. But if you come and look at that, how it's coming down, you basically see a situation where the Linux distro business was really bad for those that were trying to, quote, sell free Linux. Okay? And so it's back to this notion that this wasn't working. So then you say, well, wait a minute, it wasn't really free. IBM simultaneously is making announcements that they're making billions of dollars on their Linux-related products. Okay? So it's back to the, you know, bundle this together, ship it over here, make value on your hardware, software, services, but give the OS away for free. Well, that's fine for anybody to take a strategy of giving some part of your value away for free, but when the piece you're giving away for free is someone else's piece. So in other words, we're the ones that have the operating system. We're the ones that own Unix. Now you're giving a Unix-like OS away for free. Well, even a Unix-like OS away for free is not a problem. But it is a problem if we break that code base down and we find out that although it may have been free, it wasn't free of IP infringement. And so now that's the situation that we find ourselves in. As we go forward and look at where everything goes from an industry standpoint, you look at the drug medical business. These guys are freaked out of their minds that they're going to do something where they inadvertently attach their drug formula software to a GPL open source software that then disintegrates the value of their software. The World Intellectual Property Organization has projected numbers, maybe it was IDC, one of these two organizations projected numbers by the year 2007 that says software will be worth $229 billion. Okay? Software is what's driving industries right now. If you look at the difference in hard goods versus soft goods between 1982 and current, you'll see that the shift has gone from, in 1982 it was 30% soft goods, and in current day it's jumped up to over 60%. Okay? So the world, especially here in America, is shifting to one of an information society that is manifest in many cases with software. Okay? So the question then, in the future, is that projected $229 billion of software going to maintain? Is it going to be there? Or, in the case of the Free Software Foundation's goal, is proprietary software going to go away? Okay? Now, I admire Richard Stallman in a lot of ways in terms of what he has done over the last 20 years. He's very true to what he's about. He has taken this GNU operating environment with the Free Software Foundation. He's very passionate about what he's doing, and he's very strong about his conviction that in the future, software should be free. I mean, that is their mantra. We think proprietary software is bad, and in the future, all software should be free. And from a standpoint of intellectual property, I believe he is very intent on making sure that none of the software in there has intellectual property infringement problems with it. However, as much as I respect Richard and what he is trying to do, I totally disagree with where that goes. Is the think of a world where the $229 billion of software 3 years from now, 4 years from now, is free. Take that down to zero, and then let's project what the impact of that is in the marketplace. When you have zero price on your software, the ability to provide customer support goes way down. The quality goes down. The question of accountability is high. And one of the biggest problems is, where's the incentive for innovation? How do you get excited to get up and go after something when there isn't a payday at the end? Whether you're a drug company, whether you're Morgan Stanley doing trading algorithms, whatever it is, if you don't have something that's protectable, then why are you doing it? A number of reporters in here are going to go off and write stories. When you're done, if you don't have the ability to protect what you just wrote, the incentive starts to get a lot lower. So the negative economic impact that is felt from this, lost jobs, lack of competition, and there is a slippery slope when it starts here with software. One of the reasons the SCO issue has become so big is that we are in a tug of war right now between those who would have software be free and those who think the proprietary or the traditional licensing models are okay. And you got people pulling very hard on both sides. The people who are pulling are much larger than this little less than $100 million software company in Linden, Utah. But the reason this issue has become so big is because the stakes are very high. And based on which way SCO goes, whether SCO wins or loses, is going to have a big impact in that giant tug of war that's going on between the two forces. The flip side of this then, is software going to be free, or are we going to be able to protect intellectual property? This country was built on the notion of being able to protect your property. Early on, that wasn't expressed in intellectual property. It was more just actual property. And capitalism notions are very much built around protection and development and growth of one's property. As we look going forward, you know, the World Intellectual Property Organization has published a very nice paper that I think Blake will have available here if you want to get a copy of this on your way out, titled IP is a Power Tool for Economic Development. And that truly, in our mind, is something we subscribe to. Okay? We believe very strongly that these principles are going to be the things that catapult us to the next area of growth. I was in an investor forum yesterday where some folks from a Linux company came in and talked, and they said that they're not really doing any development work on the OS right now. And the reason for that they gave was customers don't want that. They want us to focus on things that are higher up on the stack. Well, I think what they were saying on top of that was by working on things higher up on the stack, those are things that they can sell. They can sell things that are up here and make a profit on those. To the extent that they pour R&D dollars into something that is for free, there really is no economic incentive to do that. So, again, as we look forward to a world that is not free, but rather one where we do continue to pay, it's not a free lunch environment. We think capital investment is spurred forward. You see increased R&D. And I think you just can't get past this incentive and the reward recognition process that goes along with this. I was watching Monday Night Football last night, and they had this big, bruising, 300-pound lineman on there. And this guy was, you know, just a great player. He just goes out and makes big hits and big things happen. And they talked to him and he said, "How did you get to be so good?" He said, "Well, it all started when I was 8 years old and I was out playing Pee Wee League football. And my mom told me that everybody that I knocked down and depleted, she would give me $5 for. She didn't tell my dad because he would have been upset. So I got really incented around that, and I started doing that, and that got really good." I think the power of incentives are what drive many of us to go out and do things, okay? And so that's another piece that we think is very strong with the whole model of having intellectual property that you develop, you protect, and you profit from. The positive business growth that comes off from this side of the model, you see an increased tax base. When you have an increased tax base, you can do good things with that. You see more jobs. You have a motivated workforce and an economy that thrives. You know, some of the articles that have been out there, we've taken a little bit of heat on because we're drawing out the differences between capitalism and communism. And we're not actually the ones that drew those out. We're not the ones that are out saying that our movement is based in communist or socialistic principles. But the reality is, when you look historically, what drives an economy, it's capitalist principles, not the other ones. And we think for positive business growth. If you, again, back to this country has lost a lot of jobs. If you look, go back 30 years, we used to have a very strong manufacturing base. It's gone offshore. We've lost a lot of things from a services standpoint, gone offshore. What is left? What is left are ideas. What's left in this country are concepts, ideas, being able to innovate, being able to create new things. It's information power. It's brain power. And if you take away the ability to protect that. Many in the open source movement would say patents are bad, copyrights are bad, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is bad, all these things are going to destroy us. No, it's the opposite. Those are the things that are protecting us. Those are the things that are going to spur and drive economic growth in the future. And if we do away with those, we have just reduced our ability to compete as a country going forward, because that is the critical asset that we are left with today. So to end up my talk today, I'd like to give a handful of predictions here on where we think things are going to go. I believe that in the future, today's GPL will not survive. I didn't say open source won't survive. I think open source has been around since the beginning of computing, the ability to share ideas, to have a community. Those are very powerful principles. We believe very strongly that there is a collision course going on right now, and you see it already. You see it in the Linksys acquisition by Cisco. You see this very issue at risk. Is Cisco going to lose $400 million in value because the folks at Linksys accidentally got their code tangled up with the GPL, now they got to give it away? Okay? As open source has grown up and is moving into corporate America, there are CIOs here today that will be concerned about making sure they're not giving up their intellectual property. We see this as a major stumbling block if we don't get it right. Okay? So it's on the table. IBM's drug it onto the table. It's now part of the battle. And we believe that the GPL is going to have to be reworked in a way that is going to be more pro-business in order for the two forces of corporate America or international business, for that matter, to be able to coexist peacefully with the open source movement. We believe in the future Linux will not be free. You're seeing this already. Again, count up the number of distros and how many have gone by the wayside. I made a comment 6 months ago that was controversial by stating that there was going to be a day of reckoning for some of the Linux vendors out there, including SUSE. And the day of reckoning hit last month. SUSE ran out of cash. I mean, let's make sure we all understand what happened there. They were losing money. They ran out of cash. They had an attempt to get their current investors to come and keep them going. That didn't happen. They were then put on the block, and they were bought out, okay? So now Novell is going to pick that up, and they're going to deal with the problem. But I can guarantee you, having spent 8 years at Novell and knowing how much they're driven by profit, that they're not going to sit around and worry about how to give all this stuff away. They're going to figure out how to profit off from it. Okay? If you look at Red Hat's situation, you could argue there was the day of reckoning hit 2 weeks ago with Red Hat when they came out and said in April of 2004, there's not going to be any more free Linux. Okay? So now we're looking at this, again, the whole movement of saying Linux is free, Linux is free, that's why everybody loves Linux. It's not going to be free in the future. Red Hat's not even going to support free Linux. Third prediction is that Unix on Intel will continue to drive mission-critical applications. Right now, the contenders for Unix on Intel are, and the horse race that's going on there is Linux, and it's SCO Open Server, SCO Unixware. The other one is Solaris. We think that commodity hardware is what's driving this even more than the operating system, and we're very pleased to have two of those horses on the track. Fourth prediction that we are going to make is that we will prevail in our legal battle. We have very strong claims. We are going to go down and pursue this and fight very strong for getting the compensation and damages we feel are due to us. People ask the question, why are you off deposing Linus, or why are you deposing Richard Stallman? We're deposing them because they're core to our case. IBM, on the other hand, is deposing people who are saying good things about SCO or are investing in us or doing that. They're doing things that are totally tangential. They're over here in the weeds as it relates to the case that we're working on. But they do, at the end of the day, have more attorneys in their company than I have employees, so they can do some legal tactics like that and have time to go do it. We fundamentally believe they're doing that as a mechanism to try and keep us from getting them in a courtroom in Utah in a year and a half from now. We are in a situation where we are going to fight. We have raised our cash balance. So I talked earlier about our company's worth $6 million. It's now worth over $200 million. Our cash balances have gone from $4 million to over $60 million. And we're set to fight this battle for as long as it takes at this point. Last slide, and then we'll let you get out or move on to the next presentation here. Again, I do love horses. I've used this analogy a couple of times, but if you could think of this Unix on Intel game as a horse race, and Skull starts off the race, they get around the track, they have a nice lead. Then Red Hat comes roaring up, the Skull jockey falls off, the horse runs over to the side, he's chewing on grass through the rail, he's not even in the race. Last year we got the jockey back on the horse, he's back on the track, and he's taken off down the track again, chasing after the Red Hats, chasing after Linux. We're working on closing that gap. We're very pleased with the progress we've made in the last year. As we go forward, we're going to recommit even further to the stewardship we have on the Unix marketplace and the Unix ownership that we have. At the end, when people say, how do you see all of this turning out? We hope to see a positive conclusion where we can live peacefully and coexist with the Linux environment. And we think there are ways that can happen, but clearly we are in the middle of a battle right now. We're going to keep on battling from our side, but we do hope for a day where we can get to a position where both of us can coexist. We'll still compete against each other, but we'll be able to get things resolved. Thanks for your time today, and look forward to seeing you again.
You have been listening to Darryl McBride, the CEO of the SCO Group, recorded on November 18, 2003. IT Conversations is a production of RDS Strategies, LLC. Please visit our website at www.rds.com. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of IT Conversations.